I wish you'd stand up again, George Cerny. We've heard some nice things about your guiding in particular today, George. He works with Santa Fisher in the community relations activities of the Public Relations Division here and does most of the research for the Public Relations Division. And that's how George and I are working together in this connection. He did much of the work with me in preparing the material. We're hoping tonight that we will bring together some information for you in a form that will make it more interesting, at least. And in case a physics teacher or a mathematics teacher or biologist crept in with you social scientists, we have some visual aids so he can keep himself oriented. That's about the only function of this. What I say won't be new. The information is information that has been relatively available, or readily available to most of you. There is some interpretation involved, and for that I alone am responsible, and any opinions in it are my own. They're not Midland's nor somebody else's. But I'm trying to present for you as honestly and as accurately in its perspective as I can the story of what's going on in this great Midland of America, some of the changes which are underway, and some of the influences they are having on the problems that you and I work with every day. I say, put myself in with you because we in cooperatives in general are concerned with the same kinds of things you're concerned with. Without inflicting on you or putting into your mouths a philosophy at all, I'm sure we would agree that each of us here is concerned deeply that the people we work with, and in your case the students, and in our case the people who read our publications and who own the operation here, be fully informed of the major changes occurring in the economy and in society, the social changes and economic changes, so that they may best form opinions and therefore act with reason and intelligence in very complex situations. It's not an easy task you have. And those of us who share your problems in that we're related to you in being in communications and information activities understand that it is a very difficult one for a teacher in a classroom. With all of your academic freedom that we like to support and work for with you, you have some handicaps we don't have. And we hope that the presentation tonight may help you in your work as much as it has helped us. When I speak of the changes in this region now, I do not mean Minneapolis and the Twin Cities and the area where we immediately live and work. I'm thinking primarily, first of all, of the so-called Upper Midwest, which George is about to outline for you there. I speak of this Midland of America. You might accuse me of a commercial for my employer here. I speak of this Midland of America. We have the state line shown only in light gray there because I want you so far as possible to forget artificial political boundaries tonight and think of it as an entity, one region. Around this Midland, there are influences from all portions of the North American continent. So that it's in a manageable size and shape, we've selected that area. Is there a geography teacher here who would like to take notes? It runs from 41 degrees to 55 degrees latitude, 62 to 115. But all across this area, from the salt water of the Atlantic over here to the Great Plains of Canada, big things are happening which influence this core land. And so you won't forget that that's really what we're talking about. George is showing you the theme of the whole discussion. There are truly big things ahead in this Midland of America, and they concern all of us. I've indicated how we feel that we have a common concern there, in that the people who live here shall understand those changes so they may act intelligently in the complex problems that grow out of these changes. But before we talk about these big things ahead, let's stop and see who we are now and what we do. Speaking in one vocabulary, we are food producers. More specifically, this breadbasket, this upper Midwest area in the center of this Midland of America, is a breadbasket which produces protein foods, cereals and meats, which build the country. Beyond that, we produce the raw materials for American industry, nearly all the nation's iron ore, much of the flax and wood fibers, oils and fats in soybeans, linseed and butterfat and lard, and now more energy from petroleum, soft coal, lignite. Our neighbors beyond this breadbasket area turn our raw materials into the finished products. They do this largely along the south shores of the Great Lakes and in the area near the Atlantic seacoast. Here, historically, they have turned ores to metals, for instance, and they have shipped back to us only relative small amounts of copper and steel, which we in turn fabricate here. Most of our ore, for instance, becomes metal tools and machinery that we use far from its source. It's shipped back to us. But so much for us as producers of food and of raw materials. We also produce, and this is important, men and women who eat the food and process the raw materials from this region. And we have been exporting those people. Within the core of this region, we've been moving from our farms and our small towns into the medium-sized towns and the city. And in doing this, another important fact, our girls have been leaving those locations faster than our boys. In fact, in Minnesota, we've been luring girls into the big city so fast that some sociologists see a sex problem here, a rather important economic impact. We're not keeping enough marriageable girls, or girls of marriageable age, lest I libel them all, to provide mates and mothers for the rural males. Our baby crops are in danger. In the big cities, on the other hand, we have more girls of marriageable age than boys. The competition here, some of you people can testify to. There just aren't enough to go around. That, in a sketchy way, is who we are and what we're doing. We're basically a group which exports people and raw materials. But big things are ahead which may change that picture substantially. We may start producing more finished goods proportionately. We may keep more people at home. These changes will affect everybody, of course. They'll affect people who work for wages, probably more than most people. They will, in fact, affect the students in your classroom, that by type, more than most people in the region. That is one reason that you, as social science teachers, we feel are deeply concerned. It will affect producers and those who invest their money in production facilities. And we as cooperators are deeply concerned there because it will influence the members who organize cooperatively to do business. Any major change like this immediately affects them. Now let's look at some of these changes. Now when I say big things ahead, you should understand, and I'm sure you do from your reading, that these big things are happening now. The effects of the change are the only things that are still ahead, and we can see some of those effects already. Nearly everything I speak of from now on is a reality. It is happening now, but its full impact has not been anticipated nor understood nearly as widely, parenthesis, this is my editorial, as it should be by people like you and by people like us in cooperatives. Look at that shaded area on the western edge of the map. I'm talking the light green area that George is outlining there. That is the watershed area of the Missouri River Basin. It is 1/6 of the land area of the United States. If you're a geographer here, how about a sociologist tell me about what fraction of the people in the country live there? Anybody make a wild guess? 1/20 of the people live in 1/6 of the land area, that being the Missouri Basin. It extends farther south than our map, but tapers off rapidly toward the south and east from the bottom of the map. There are seats in front, and I think you'll enjoy it more later. If somebody who has to bob ahead moves for it, I won't be embarrassed a bit, and I'm sure the others won't. I'll bellow over you any noise you make hitting a chair. Until our generation, this Missouri Basin had been little thought of in itself as an economic region. Most of the activity had been there on individual spotty basis. A miner mines some gold. A rancher fattens some cattle. A sheepman clips some wool. In general, it had been spotty development and had been little thought of as an economic area, though of course the early explorers early defined it as a watershed area. All the water falling in that green area ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. Grasshoppers, depression, drought, and those things of the 30s probably were the first indications that people stirred into action in thinking of it as a region. Though men, then called visionaries, had as early as 1900 said that here is the great future of America. Lots of grass, lots of land, massive streams, and lots of water if we only did something about it. No sooner had they spoken the words, depending on the season of the year, and a flood or a drought canceled the impact of their statements. Irrigation people in the far west at the upper ends of the great rivers there were interested in developing that and worked through the Bureau of Reclamation. The Bureau of Reclamation, part of the Department of Interior, has authority over water in the 17 western states. Geography teachers for notes, it's west of 92 degrees longitude, which is roughly one-third of the way into the Dakotas there from the east. People downstream harassed by floods worked with the Army engineers. They have authority over all navigable streams so far as flood control and navigation works are concerned. These by acts of Congress. Western growers wanted the water held upstream for irrigation. Southern interests wanted enough of it held back to prevent floods, but the rest of it coming down to ensure what they called cheap water transportation downstream. And you can see there was room for lots of conflicts. It was really the flood of 1943, which is a baby flood now as we think of floods, which caused the most serious upheavals. There was rather serious damage from it. At the same time this flood struck, there were people in Congress much interested in developing the basin on the principles of the Tennessee Valley Authority. In fact, President Roosevelt had before him a proposal to create a Missouri Valley Authority. People of the western states were not inclined to accept that idea at all for their basin. So they hurried two plans. The Reclamation people, a plan which is known from its author or the chief architect of the plan, William Glenn Sloan, developed the Sloan Plan. He was assistant regional director for the Reclamation Service up in Billings, Montana. The Army people hurried together the so-called Pick Plan, named after Lewis A. Pick, who was then the Army engineer at Omaha, responsible for the Upper Missouri Basin. And those two plans were ready for presentation for Congress when the ugly word Missouri Valley Authority was shouted out to them. And rather than be in a position of conflict, the two forces met in Omaha, and here some loaded words have been used. It's been called the Omaha Compromise. It's been called the shotgun wedding with an illegitimate child. But out of the marriage anyway came a new plan. It wasn't really. It was the Pick Plan plus the Sloan Plan. It's called Pick-Sloan Plan and includes, with one exception, every project that each of them had thought of. That was approved by Congress as the Flood Control Act of 1944, and it is under that basic act that these big things are happening in the Missouri Basin. There is a third agency at work, and it is here again I'm offering editorial comment that is in harmony with that of most men I know who have studied it without having a direct personal basis for favoring the Bureau or the Army Engineers. This third plan is really the plan that's in work, but it isn't known as such. I call it the Interagency Plan. For, after the Pick-Sloan Plan was approved, the states of the basin and all of the federal agencies, some 20 of them, who were involved in any way in federal activities out there, organized an unofficial Missouri Basin Interagency Committee. It has no legal standing. It has no authority to act. It represents an interesting example of people being compelled to be reasonable and democratic through the sheer pressure of the people in the other 38 states. All or portions of 10 states are in the basin. If they don't get together, they don't get appropriations. And if they fight each other, they're lost. So it is this Missouri Basin Interagency Committee meeting once a month, which reconciles conflicting views, and they will all agree this month we'll go after this project plus that one, and for the next 18 months, that's it. So we bite off a chunk at a time. Remember, Congress authorized the plan, but did not appropriate money for its entirety. The entire project, all phases of it, come close to $15 billion because the Missouri Basin Interagency Committee has endorsed and supported still a third master plan laid on top of the Pick and the Sloan plans. You may call it the Young Plan, though the man whose name I'm using would be the first to say that isn't exactly right. He is Gladwin Young from the Department of Agriculture in Lincoln, Nebraska, who pulled together all of the agriculture department's plans for soil improvement, upper watershed development, strip contour farming, and all of those modern devices that are well known. He said, look, if we do a lot of that work in this basin, we can really help in flood control and water use and increase the fertility or the production, at least, of the basin. That is the agriculture department's plan. Went before Congress 3 years ago, and nothing has happened. The Missouri Basin Interagency Committee has endorsed it. So they are now in the position of adding the Pick Plan plus the Sloan Plan plus the Young Plan, and that I call the Missouri Basin Interagency Committee Plan, or the Interagency Project. What the Agricultural Plan does, in very briefly, and I'm oversimplifying, it would do in about 25 years what at our present rate of improvement would take 100 years in the way of improved use of land, erosion control, increased use of fertilizers and soil conditioners. This master plan, this interagency plan, this whole thing now, would harness nearly every drop of water that flows in the basin, every raindrop that wants to start down toward the Gulf of Mexico. In fact, one disputed project out in Colorado even would take rain that naturally heads for the west coast in the Pacific Ocean and send it into the Missouri Basin watershed through a tunnel under the Continental Divide. That's the Colorado Big Thompson Project. It's not so ridiculous. I mean, it sounds funny, but you'll hear some stranger and bigger things yet. The basis of the plan is that large dams will be used on the main stem of the river, 6 of them, and about 100 smaller dams, 56 that you and I would consider pretty good size, medium dams they're called, like the Ford Lock, some dam over here, on tributaries, to act as reservoirs to hold back floodwaters and to contain waters which could be used for irrigation. The whole project would combine irrigation, navigation, flood control, power, that is the generation of hydroelectric power, additional recreation facilities, and increased land use or improved land use. The major dams are these, starting at the upper end of the Missouri River. First, the Fort Peck Dam in Montana. That was built before the combined project was improved. Under the present project, more generators are being added now there to increase power output. It involves, for instance, expanding tunnels which were built only 26 feet in diameter to 28 feet, putting new steel tubes to get more water running down to turn the turbines. Think in big figures when you're thinking about it. Big things ahead is no fooling. Downstream, well, work is well underway on the largest earthen dam in the world. That's a 2-mile-long dam at Garrison, North Dakota. It will close the Missouri River in another year. It will start effective operation so far as generating power 2 years after that. Completed, it will have cost about $265 million. Below it, work has started on the Wa'ee Dam. Watch my lips, it's a toughie. It's spelled O-A-H-E and pronounced from the Sioux, Wa'ee, and I don't know what it means. It will back up water for 250 miles, nearly, to Bismarck, North Dakota. Bismarck is slightly below the Garrison Dam. Still farther downstream in South Dakota, there are 3 more dams with work far along on one of them. One is proposed at Big Bend, a few miles south of here, and the one at Fort Randall is now under construction. The third one in South Dakota at Gavin's Point is not yet completely designed or approved by Congress so far as spending money on construction. All of these structures, the big dams, and they're called reservoirs because the land areas back of them are also involved, development of those, will have cost more than $800 million. I used that figure by totaling up cost estimates of the agencies that they gave in 1949. You make your own estimate of their underestimate of costs and add to it inflation, and I'm sure you would agree with me, it's reasonable to say more than $1 billion will be the actual total cost of the major structures. With these dams will be more irrigation. Relatively little land is irrigated in the Dakotas now. One idea is to irrigate a large area along the Canadian border in North Dakota. George will show you that one now. The gadget he's sticking on the map outlines the Missouri-Souris, S-O-U-R-I-S, irrigation project. The plan here, George can follow it with a pointer, we'll take it slowly, but it's kind of interesting. Watch what happens to this water. Is to take water from the Missouri River, move it in a canal over to the Souris River. The Souris flows at the south edge of that green blob from Canada, down around there, and back into Canada again. Only a loop of the Souris is in the United States. It drains up into Hudson's Bay. Proposal is to move water over to the Souris. It's often called the Mouse River by natives. If you have any students who came from North Dakota, it's the Mouse River. Let it run along that loop of the river inside the United States, irrigate that land in the dark green area. Then the engineers propose to take it out of the river again before the river runs back into Canada. Remember, in irrigation, this principle is involved. Engineers can explain it, and I think I vaguely understand, but I'll just give you the facts. Trust me, they're reasonably accurate. that it takes 5 units of water to run an irrigation system for each unit that actually gets into the crop. You see, 4/5 of the water that starts down the irrigation way comes out at the other end. That's the thing to remember here. So that's how there's still water left after we've done the irrigation. At the end of that loop, the water would run across to Old Devil's Lake, North Dakota, freshen that area somewhat. The rest would run down the James River in North Dakota and the Cheyenne River over to the Red River in the north, and part of it back up to Hudson's Bay, and the rest of it down the James River in South Dakota, all the way down to that last dam in the series, back into the Missouri River where it was running before anyway. But meanwhile, it will have irrigated about 500,000 acres of land if the plan is sound, and if it goes through. It will have provided additional water supplies for towns which have trouble in drought days, as you know. They sink the second and the third well, and they still come up with something not so potable if you travel there in the 30s. It will aid industry if some wishes to develop there, and water shortages have been a serious handicap. That original plan has been modified somewhat. They found the land that looked enticing is not as suitable for irrigation as first thought of. And more attention now is being given to a second large irrigation project in the Dakotas. This area is along the James River, approximately centering at Huron, South Dakota. This too would be irrigated with Missouri River water, and it's known as the Wah-E Irrigation Project. George will show you the Wah-E Irrigation Project around Huron. The water here would come from above the Wah-E Dam. By pumping water from above the dam, that is up over the bank from the reservoir level, now it's a big lake, think of it, over the bank, east bank of the Missouri River, be lifted into a canal, and then would flow eastward into the James River, be used for irrigation at that dark area. An interesting bit of geography makes this project look possible and economic. The water would drop over a sharp decline at the west side of the James River Valley. I don't want to labor the point of geography with you, but as you know, a river has to be in the low point here, and there's higher ground on each side. The water dropping over the west bank of the James River Valley there would be harnessed around Miller, South Dakota at the Miller Power Drop and would be used to produce electrical energy before it goes on to water crops. That electrical energy would be transmitted back to the Wah-E Dam site to the west and would there be used to pump the water out. Now, it is not an example of what you say can't be done in perpetual motion, because the facts are that the drop at the east end is greater than the lift that would be required at the west end. In fact, there's a net gain of about 15% left over to do anything you want with, according to the engineering figures on the electrical energy losses and yields involved. That's kind of an interesting part of the project that you might want to hear. There are gimmicks and interesting parts to any of these big things that make them possible if men put their heads together and want to make them work, if somebody's willing to finance the initial investment. Nearly everything I mentioned has some such engineering marvel in it. Good teachers ever go to school, here's a swell place to take a course to make arithmetic interesting for the fellow who balks at it. The fellow who wants to run the great big earth-moving vehicles out there, and I mean big, 30 yards to a load. The big trucks you see around town haul 4 yards. That's a big truck. 30 yards to a load, 20 miles an hour, traffic control signs. And the insurance company's busy with safety men running all over in helmets to say, you can't drive this way on the left-hand side. That kind of thing, with huge earth-moving equipment. Working 20 hours a day, 2 10-hour shifts, because they need the other 4 hours to repair and maintain the equipment. This isn't because the men are resting, the other crew's working that 4 hours in maintenance. Things like that are, the valley is just loaded with it for social science, political science, and other kinds of science teachers. Well, that in brief is what they're doing out there. I should say what we're doing, because it's federal money and we're all sharing the investments out there. I haven't touched on the dozens of smaller dams, those 56 medium-sized ones like the Ford Dam over here. And I haven't mentioned these hundreds of small earthen works and upstream reservoirs or the soil control programs. Now, you can get a good debate on this whole thing, as you can see, because it's big, it's expensive, and it involves major changes in the economy of the region. And people choose up sides out there at the drop of the hat. They're really Democrats in that solid Republican voting area of South Dakota. I mean, they're Democratic. When I was covering the news out there for Associated Press, I thought they voted tombstones, but I found they didn't. But half of the people voted. Can you imagine that? Half the people voted. Now, that's not half of the eligible registered voters. That's half the people. I said, that can't happen. But then I did some arithmetic and found that 1/3 of the adults had a direct relation to the state or county or federal government they either worked for or got money from. Well, they're interested in it. I'm not covering the controversies here or the major viewpoints that are expressed, but you can see the possibilities. And I'm not going to offer my personal opinions as to how it will all come out, other than to tell you that I am convinced, and those who have watched it carefully, critics and friends of it, say that these things will be developed, and the effects of them will be felt. And we feel in cooperatives, and we assume you feel as teachers, that somebody ought to be studying and understanding these things and adjusting to the changes. Out of each of those dams will be power-generating facilities. This electric power is being created at dams built by general public investment by all the taxpayers. The law has said for a long time that such power must first be made available to public bodies. Then, in order, it may be sold to non-profit organizations, such as the rural electric cooperatives. But there are lots of things to consider here. Some people pretend the plan results in waste. They say the federally financed power lines that would have to be built would duplicate private lines. Well, they used to say that. The people who used to say that, by and large, were those who objected to federal activity in the field, and in particular, some of the large power companies. They no longer say that, for they found a way to get along with the REA, and now they have their own combined plan to be sure that Congress appropriates the money and that part of it gets built. It's very interesting how people are getting cozy and differences disappear. None of the public bodies that I know of proposes two parallel lines, and never did, really. The question, really, now, is how to move the power most efficiently without, on the one hand, making a gift of profits to somebody on a public investment, or, on the other hand, of saying that it goes into non-profit hands at great expense to somebody else subsidizing it. Those are the two gross extremes, and the public policy has settled on middle course again. One solution has come out of all the bad name-calling that went on. I tell you, there were stories out there that you were almost ashamed to write and print, but they were gentlemen saying these things about each other, and they were black names they were using. It was fun being a reporter in those days. The combination is a combination of a hookup of electric lines owned by the privately owned cooperatives and those owned by the private profit utilities. This combined distribution system would be hooked into, and the key to it is, a master grid connecting all of the major dams of the Missouri Basin and delivering that energy into the area George has outlined. By name, it runs roughly from Yankton, South Dakota on the south, on over into southern Minnesota, up toward the Mankato vicinity, Granite Falls, Fargo, on across over there to Bismarck, and then down south again. The spur running north of Bismarck runs up to the Garrison Dam. Now let's go down the Waiee Dam at Pierre, South Dakota. And then that one that runs across, remember the Miller Power Drop I told you about? And then on over into Minnesota again. Watertown, South Dakota, he touched, and then into Minnesota. There also is a link from the Garrison Dam to the Fort Peck Dam, a tie-in line of lower voltage. But that is the grid over which the debate is now hinging in Congress. Shall they or shall they not spend the money that's involved to build that as a publicly financed power line, the master grid, to be operated by the Bureau of Reclamation? 20 cooperatives and the private utilities or private profit type operations in the basin have all agreed to this plan and say, look, that's what we want you to do. Congress has not given final approval in the form of an appropriation yet. Well, now, so far, I've spent a lot of time on one topic. I've discussed largely the Missouri Basin and the control and use of water. We have barely touched on the use of land surface out there. I leave it to your imagination to add some of the effects of greatly increasing the land which can produce wet farm crops, that is, irrigated land, which can produce sugar beets, beans of various kinds, forage, which now is not readily available in some parts. Dairying then could be supported. Small creameries and dairies where there are none now. I can remember at times there when I could find no milk in country where they produced more good cattle than you could believe possible, great big fat, but they were he cows and no milk. These changes make some of those things possible, not just so I can get a glass of milk, understand, but because people will make money doing that and will live better lives and more population will be supported. They aren't building these dams so I can get a glass of milk when I go out to look at Mount Rushmore. That isn't the idea. I mentioned so far only one major project and the related electricity. Next few minutes, we're going a lot faster. These things, too, are big. George is going to show you now, and it's a fancy gadget. United States end of a geological formation that's changing the pattern of petroleum distribution in the United States. Now what he's putting on there is the outline, and the brown area shows the interior of it, of an area known as the Williston Basin. If you want to think of it as a basin, let's get into the house, and it's like a wash basin in the teacher's restroom, only much bigger. That basin is formed of granite, and inside of the basin are sedimentary rocks. It's in sedimentary rocks only that granite is found. And now I learned a year ago that I must modify that, because some geologists say that with modern techniques, and this was a man, by the way, who was working in Canada for Imperial Oil, he said, Mr. Michelson, he said, I will not condemn anything except very tight granite anymore as having a possibility of containing oil after some of the things we found. But this is the area in which the granite basin is found, and it pinches out toward the edges of that. Not all of that contains sedimentary rocks, which might contain petroleum. But in that area, they have found oil. In this area lies some of the great petroleum reserves. And I use that word cautiously, because the areas within the basin, which have been reasonably well explored, are small, and the oil has been found there at relatively high cost. Drilling is expensive in this basin as compared with the Texas area, for instance. So they're not punching holes down as fast as many different places. It's cautious drilling. This area fades out to the north on our map. Most geologists say it's the same type of formation that we find in Canada, where fabulous oil fields were been discovered by the American Canadian explorers. I think you know the story of Alberta oil and the discovery in 1947. That oil in Canada was good oil, high in quality, seemed to be almost unlimited amounts from wells which are easy and cheap to drill in that area. So much they couldn't use it in Canada. So with $56 million, the oil firms built a 1,200-mile pipeline to move that crude oil out of Canada closer to their markets. They ran that pipeline across Minnesota to the head of the Great Lakes. It ends at Superior, Wisconsin. This changed the pattern of petroleum marketing. For a generation, we in the United States had found our petroleum in the southwestern United States and sold it in the populous or heavily populated areas in northeastern United States, in the industrial northeast. This Canadian oil discovery changed the direction of flow and market conditions. The new Canadian oil now moves down the Great Lakes in tankers as far as Detroit. Really, it's to Sarnia, Ontario, which is just across from Detroit, where it is refined by a large American firm with a Canadian name, and is sold largely in Canada. In addition to that activity of Canadian capital and with Canadian oil reserves being moved down the Great Lakes to Detroit, we are seeing the effects of it now in Minnesota. A refinery has been built outside of Duluth, Minnesota, which runs on Canadian crude oil. Gasoline from that refinery is trucked into our resort area, so at a little station near my cabin in the Walker vicinity, if I want to buy gasoline from a non-co-op station, I get Alberta oil within 182 miles of Minneapolis in the form of gasoline I can burn in my automobile. And there's lots of it up there. But as though that Canadian oil wasn't enough to send people scurrying around and changing this market, from an area where there was no oil to an area with an overabundance of oil moving into this market area, the men who had been exploring in the Dakotas struck oil in the Williston Basin, and it's named geologically because the axis, or the deepest portion of that basin, center line, runs generally near Williston, North Dakota. Struck oil there a year ago. This oil lies in small deposits, small areas within the sedimentary rocks. The underground formation, which is susceptible and may be containing oil, continues southward into South Dakota, as you'll notice it there. George is showing you the discovery well there now in the Williston Basin, discovered by Amarant Petroleum. There are now 9 producers in an area where there were none a year ago. There are 17 holes scheduled for drilling. If at all the present ratio, you would say that about 1/3 at the best of those would produce some kind of oil. Estimates on the new reserve are rather uncertain, as I mentioned before, but it is important. Exploration has been less intensive in South Dakota. Parenthesis, another editorial to you. They will find oil in South Dakota too someday. I say that because I guessed right on the first one. I'm not a geologist. The point is that there's so much land under lease and so many large firms with enough capital to do the exploration work that with formations being very, very similar, geologists who advise men where to spend money drilling holes in the ground say, it's worth hunting, you're going to find something eventually, just keep drilling. Now, keeping it up is very expensive. It costs about $250,000 from the time you start till you have your first hole completed. And then you hope you pick the right place. A hole, by the way, is about 8 to 10 inches in diameter. North Dakota's a pretty big place to punch holes that size and expect to cover the state. So far, we've talked about more food production out in the Missouri Basin, more electric power, relief from floods perhaps, at least some help in flood control. Rich new sources of energy in the form of petroleum. All of them right next to us, right in our backyard, and affecting us who up till now have been the financial hub and the general center of economic interest, at least for the Dakotas and eastern Montana. You're probably familiar, too, of course, with the discoveries in two places of a resource we've known much more about in the past, or we should have. That's the discovery I'm referring to now, discoveries of iron ore in Labrador, and in Venezuela. Venezuelan story is getting told pretty well by the people who are interested in it and are concerned with the tax situation at home here, what people here may do about their taxes up north. So we hear quite a bit about Venezuelan ore. We don't hear so much about this other ore up in Labrador. We haven't drawn a line between Quebec and Labrador because that ore field flops into both of them. George has some repair work to do, and so I'll just tell you that that black line, if you'll look at it, is a railroad line which is being built down there to move the ore from Labrador down to a town called Seven Islands out here at the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, this being the St. Lawrence. Now look at that pool of ore, or that body up in Labrador. American firms, five of them, pool their resources to develop it. They have at their call $225 million, according to their testimony to Congress, for developing that. Right now, they can write checks on it. It's in the bank. It'll be about 1956 before the ore starts coming down from there in quantity. Till that time, the men are building the railroad line from the ore fields down to salt water, the Port of Seven Islands. Here, the firms say that they'll move that ore over the existing water routes, part of it, to the southern Great Lakes steel centers, using existing canals, along the St. Lawrence. Some of it by freshwater and rail into the Pittsburgh area. Some more of it, all water, salt water, down to the Chesapeake Bay area. Now, if the Labrador ore moves by salt water in quantity out there, what does it do to the industrial area of the southern Great Lakes, south shore there, which is now basically built around the fact that you can get coal and limestone and iron ore together cheaply and quickly, produce a lot of material, and then the fabrication takes place close to the center of the steel production. It affects it. It changes it. That is one motive for people saying that we must do something to ensure that the age-old dream comes true. That is the construction of the St. Lawrence Seaway so we have an all-water route from salt water to fresh water in the heart of the Midland region so that ocean-going vessels can dock at Duluth, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Chicago. Proposal in the St. Lawrence Seaway. I'm oversimplifying engineering for sake of time, and I hope you don't think I'm misleading you. I'm trying to just hit it at the highest point. The key idea is to deepen the water route, because we do have a water route to salt water now, is to deepen it so it will take larger vessels. The limiting factor now is a 14-foot clearance in the canal, in the one canal to the east. Proposal is to give a clearance of 27 feet. There you'll get argument that depending on whether a man is testifying for the railroads or whether he's testifying for the shipping firms that live in Chicago as to what a 27-foot canal means. I am satisfied, and again, it's an opinion now, which is my own, that the basic truth of it is not necessarily dead center between those two forces at all, but that with a 27-foot canal, you can move very large vessels profitably in here. And that it is unfair to say that that will not permit very large ones because they would require more than that clearance. Because the facts are you can load a vessel only partly and move it economically through the freshwater area. Complete your cargo out at the far end here with your mixed cargo vessels and continue on with an extremely heavy draw of water into your ocean. But whatever comes out of that 14 to 27 foot clearance, the principles involved are that the water route would be deepened and controlled as to level with a series of locks and dams. There's roughly a 600 foot drop from Duluth to the salt water. That's how far those lakes change level in that distance, all of it flowing eastward. So it's necessary for a boat to climb a ladder through a series of locks, a total of 600 feet coming from salt water up to Duluth. You do that in a series of some 14 lifts or more. The key to it is the International Rapids section. All of the work, for practical purposes, will be concentrated about 47 miles of the waterway, and George is putting a yellow gadget on to show you where that is, the International Rapids section there. You're familiar in general with the arguments. If you're like I am as an editor, and social science teachers seem to get hit the same way, you have had numerous pamphlets from people who oppose it and some from people who favor it. And out of that, you're supposed to form an opinion. That's in general, the people who oppose it live in Gulf ports, southern United States, and Atlantic ports. Those folks say that this seaway would attract so much commerce that they would suffer. Joining them in opposition are the railroads, in general, who say that the seaway is not a practical thing, that not much will happen and not as much commerce will move as it advocates claim, and therefore it's uneconomic, too big an investment for the amount of traffic that will flow. Now, they found a way to get those two conflicting views together and both oppose it. The people who favor it say that it is economically a sound project because it will pay for itself. The tolls will pay for themselves, and that the dams required, the electric power generated, will pay for it. Its share of the cost there. And then we get the arguments not based alone on economics, which say that we have agreed with Canada and did in 1941 to join them in the project. We must keep good faith and show we get along in harmony with our friends across the border and be a detriment to democracy abroad. But there is a principle involved there, and long orations with the short fact that it might help our foreign relations. Of course, port cities along the route say that this thing would be so good that we must have it, because the whole nation would benefit from the improvements that would be brought to this great Midland region. Those of us who live here, with very few exceptions, and I mean those of us who act through pressure groups, are in favor of it. Our chambers of commerce, our cooperatives, of course, because the farmers see great benefits in it. Many other independent business groups, and even the Western railroads, have not opposed it, but that may be, again, a matter of public relations as well as the belief that it would generate new traffic for them to in turn haul back and forth to the ports. I don't know the motives there. One of the most interesting claims in favor of it is the one which is very difficult to measure, is the direct economic effect, beneficial effect, it would have on this area as a protein-producing region. The proponents point out that their statistics show, and they say prove, I say their statistics indicate, and they say prove, that it would amount to a savings of 3 up to 8 cents a bushel on the movement of wheat alone from this area to salt water. Whatever the figure might be, if it is true that there is a savings, it could do two things. It could reduce the price of our wheat in foreign markets and still yield the same amount for the farmer at home. Or at the same price as now in foreign markets, that savings and freight could be used to pay the farmer more at home. You can do it then, food to hungry people at lower cost, or at the same price the people back here are helping them with other kinds of aid programs. If you want to be international about it, if you want to be very selfish and regional, it looks like a good thing of putting more buying power into this region. And that is one of the strongest arguments by the farm groups. There is another one, which we as cooperatives are concerned with. With any savings in freight costs from the east, it means again that the fabricated product can move to us at lower cost, making it more readily available and therefore bringing the advantages of mechanization at lower cost to the farmer, requiring him to invest less capital in machinery and equipment and fabricated items in order to remain in the farming business. Well, I've touched on that. I've given you, I hope, in this time, a quick picture of some of the big things that are ahead. I must, in fairness, point out to you many things that I have not touched on. Let's review them quickly. More energy in the form of electric power, petroleum. More metals, at least iron ore. Now, I haven't touched on uranium, copper, nickel, zinc, all of which have been found recently in some quantities in this region and some of them in important quantities. the possibility of cheaper transportation to and from the east and to the whole world. Let's not stop at the line here. If I can get to the salt water, I can go any place on the globe by salt water. If you taught me geography, right, or the people ahead of you there. I haven't talked anything now about lignite and soft coal and what can be done with them, and they're in vast quantities in the Dakotas, Wyoming, and Montana. Lignite can be turned into gasoline. It can be the basis for a petrochemical industry as well as petroleum can be. Hydrocarbon is the way you handle it. And great strides have been made in finding ways to do those things practically, economically, that is, at a competitive price. I haven't talked to the future of the cutover areas of the northern forest states and what can be done now with more resource, more energy available to those. I haven't mentioned that along with petroleum comes natural gas, and so much of it in Alberta that they're having a time figuring out what they're going to do with it. And natural gas in vast quantities on its way to us, again, from the north. Now we burn gas in our homes where we have it, and gas goes from south of us. I haven't said anything about changes that are possible and are coming, because they already have started showing up, in land use without any major federal activity. Krillium is a soil conditioner. Increased use of fertilizers and better fertilizers, more suitable and tailored to the needs, such as the cooperatives are helping build and produce and are distributing, farmers owning their own facilities for that kind of work, and other firms too supplying. I haven't talked about changes in feeds and seeds and the use of feeds and seeds, so with the same effort put in, you get more out of an animal, or that the land produces more tonnage of food. We haven't talked about any of those things. I've talked about great big things you can see and feel and get your hands on. Pieces of land, water, pipelines, mines, derricks, things like that. These things a little harder. They're here. They're big and they're happening. I haven't said a thing about taconite in northern Minnesota, which you know about, which will employ more people because it is a manufacturing process than does our mining industry now, which is a digging, shipping process. But putting all of these resources together, and all of these changes, I think it's quite obvious that there are big things ahead. Well, I as an editor, always feel it's a shame, as a reporter for 18 years, my first time to write editorial. I'd like to write one with you. I'd like to urge that you analyze these things to see what they mean, particularly the students you're teaching. We're trying to do it to see what it means to the people we serve. Think of what it can mean to increase the food supply, increase the population, provide some quantity of small industries scattered throughout the area where people are now leaving for lack of work and occupation. The change that's possible in the shifting of people. Oh, and I should go back and mention something that's so obvious to everybody. What is happening to the communications all through the region as we now start talking about rural television on top of rural radio and more newspapers and faster mail service and better roads? As these people all start mixing together now in a fin in the cutover area, and the Swede and the corn country get to know each other on a different basis than they used to, you see, and their friends maybe. Less dependence on rail transportation with the water routes and improved highways, which we haven't studied, and comparative reduction in freight charges. There will come, with these things we call economic changes, sociological changes that almost defy the imagination. You can see some of them. I think you can guess it. There'll be a more closely knit region because of more communication and travel, and again, continued dependence. There are bound to be more schools. We hope there'll be more understanding between urban and rural residents, a very serious social problem, I feel, in our area. For teachers, we're telling the public every day, and we're trying to do practical things besides writing editorials about it. We're going to need more teachers, and we're going to need better teachers, with no disparagement on you. The person that takes your place is going to have to understand more than you had to understand. And he's going to be competing with more other media making impact on the kids. He's going to have to do a better job of getting the information across and molding people. We'll have to provide the training for those teachers. So we've got to start right now, you and I, with more schools. I'm just talking about things teachers can see that affect teachers. And some of these would happen anyway. Some of these changes are inevitable. But they must happen with the tremendous change in these economic developments. And all through it, we have a social concern that these changes be made so that they truly benefit the most people. Not in the sense that the people all go out and own them all, federally, state, socially. We think that there's the mixture, the cooperative is the one that stands for this mixture. Some places already want the postal service, some places we don't want government sticking its fingers in at all. And we like what we call a cooperative middle way as being a good system that balances and polices a variety of types of operations. But somewhere in there, we feel that it's important that people understand these changes so they'll participate in the change. And that these changes will come, these big things ahead will really mean better living for everybody in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon. We're going to fully switch the, I don't see the clock, but we tailor-made this evening's program so that we could officially adjourn at 8:30. We do have one more thing that we had scheduled, but with my good friend Mr. Zetti's cooperation, I think we will hold an official presentation on the question, do cooperatives pay taxes? We are going to ask Doc to stand ready and answer that if any of you care to pop the question, particularly you ladies, since this is leap year. So right at this moment, I'm watching the clock a little bit, but this is a question period. We hope you haven't felt too filled by this educationally loaded capsule on big things that are happening. I would only make one little comment. In trying to properly evaluate and anticipate, I'd say that if we stand high enough on our tiptoes, there are really and truly big things ahead educationally, which I'd like to burden you with sometime in the future, but not tonight. The question is, period is now here. What do you have on your cuffs that you want to flip off and ask one of these folks, how about it?
How do they pay tax?
Doc, M.D. Zetti's legal counsel, just recently permitted to practice before the Supreme Court. Come up and take a bow.
I want to be sure to qualify that because have to be able to practice before the Supreme Court in this state before you can practice anywhere, period. He meant the Supreme Court of the United States.
Oh.
Who asked that question?
I don't know. I heard three people's lips moving on.
Did you say, how do the co-ops pay taxes?
I know they pay taxes. I've heard it, had it drummed into me, but I still can't tell other people in exactly what way they pay taxes. I know some of the simple ones, but not the big taxes.
Well, if I might be a little facetious, it's just as painful for them as it is for other people. First of all, Gordon took me through here so fast and I got so interested, I'm glad I didn't have to make a speech because I forgot what I was going to say anyway.
Now, how does co-ops pay taxes?
It would be almost an astronomical task to answer that completely, but let me put it this way. There is a group of cooperatives. They are a peculiar type of cooperative, not so peculiar in this state, but the purely farmers cooperative association that may, under certain circumstances, be wholly exempt from the federal income tax. Now, when we speak about this tax problem, let's keep one thing in mind, and if you don't take anything else away from here tonight about taxes and co-ops, remember that this entire tax problem involves only income taxes, no other tax. The farmers' co-op that is tax exempt and meets very rigid requirements doesn't pay federal income taxes, and in most states they do not pay state income taxes. And the reason they don't pay income taxes is because they don't have income, actually. Because if they meet the requirements of the statute and are wholly tax exempt, the entire net savings of that organization is held in trust for the patrons. And title to these savings or the earnings or whatever you want to call it never passes into the possession of that cooperative association. Now, the physical possession goes to the co-op, just as the physical possession of your money goes to a bank when you deposit it there, but when you draw that money out, you wouldn't think of including it on your tax return, heaven forbid, because the bank merely held that money for you so that you could get it back at an appointed time or on demand. Now, In the case of the cooperative association that does pay taxes, the non-exempt cooperative, of which Midland happens to be one, and in this state, I don't have the exact figure, there are others here who may have it, less than a third of the cooperative associations that could qualify for exemption don't take advantage of it because the requirements are just too restrictive. As to the co-ops that do pay taxes, they pay taxes at the same rates, under exactly the same statute, at the same time, and subject to exactly the same regulations as any other business corporation. Now, you might ask me, well, why is it that people say co-ops don't pay taxes? Well, there's a lot of confusion connected with that kind of conclusion. A co-op probably doesn't pay the same amount of taxes on the same dollar volume of business for the reason that it employs a completely different technique in business. A private profit corporation, the normal business corporation, when it receives earnings into the corporation, those earnings are available for distribution to the stockholders on the basis of their investment in the corporation. Now, in the cooperative association, the earnings come into the corporation, but they do not belong to the stockholders by reason of their investment in the corporation. The earnings belong to the patron who put the money in there. That isn't true in the business corporation. The cooperative does business with the patron on this basis. We'll charge you for the service we render a certain amount of money, which will probably be competitive. With that money, we'll provide you the goods, we'll provide you the service, we'll pay our expenses. We may even pay a dividend on capital stock. We may put something into surplus. Everything that's left, we're going to return it to you. Well, money received, subject to an obligation to return it, doesn't become the property of the recipient, just the same as your money didn't become the property of the bank. Now, to the extent that cooperative takes money from a patron and turns it over to a stockholder as a dividend on capital stock, it has assumed title, and that is income to the cooperative. To the extent also that it takes money from the patron and builds up a surplus account, as the statute requires, the co-op has assumed title to that money and pays a tax on it. One other item the co-op pays a tax on is this. If it does business with a patron and doesn't keep records, or if the patron doesn't identify himself, so that at the end of the year, the co-op can't return that savings to the patron, that is also taxed, the savings on that proportion of business to which a return is not made to the patron. That is also taxed. So you see that to the extent that a cooperative association has profit and has income that it receives, it pays taxes the same as any other business. I didn't mean to make a speech to answer your question. Now, I'd like to say one more thing. To the extent that a business that isn't a cooperative returns as a rebate any part of its earnings to its patrons, it receives the same tax treatment as the cooperative because rebates are excludable from income. Does that help answer your question?
Rather complicated. But here's another gentleman that has a question.
In what way does the patron put his money into the cooperative? Is it in the form of a drawing account of some kind, I mean, a sum that he draws on or purchases? Is it very similar to buying stock in any corporation?
That is determined entirely by the membership and to some extent by the state law. The membership may decide that the association or the board of directors should be given authority to withhold in the cooperative association these earnings, the cash earnings, until there's enough working capital to economically operate that association. But when the money is actually withheld, they must issue something. They must give that patron something to notify him that he has made a contribution to the capital of that organization. He may get a share of stock, he may get a certificate of indebtedness, or he may get just a letter notifying him that something has been put into a reserve to his credit. Now, the mere fact that he didn't receive it in cash and the members and patrons got together and agreed that the co-op shall have that authority doesn't mean that he hasn't received something of value, because he has built for himself a capital equity in that corporation. And the receipt by him of capital stock or some other capital equity is the same as receiving cash under our income tax statute.
Well, Doc, if I interpreted the gentleman's question correctly, I thought he meant, can a member deposit for savings with his cooperative and make withdrawals against that prepaid credit balance which he has created? Is that what you meant?
No, I didn't mean that. I think he answered about what I was thinking.
Good.
I was thinking the one statement you had previously made about how the patron was going to be returned, so it was going to be given a return, and I think that's sufficient, and I think you answered.
I'd just like to toss out this one little comparison. A couple of years ago, I figured out that for each dollar that we pay as a corporation on real estate and personal property taxes in the city of Minneapolis, 27 cents of it is dedicated to education. Down in Milwaukee, where we have facilities, 33 1/3% of each tax dollar goes to the schools. Down in Cushing, Oklahoma, where we own a refinery, 67 cents out of each tax dollar goes to the schools. And I might add further that because of the semi-public nature of the cooperative corporation, there isn't much opportunity for the accounting department or anybody to do any hocus-pocus work at inventory time to reduce inventory or refuse to admit the full value of inventory. As we know that it's done sometimes in the hands of private corporations that do not have their books semi-public records.
I might just mention this fact that would be interesting to you. In the last 5 years, the Midland, which is a tax-paying cooperative, has paid over $1.5 million in state and federal income taxes and real estate and personal property taxes, and that's beside the unemployment taxes and Social Security taxes and other taxes that we pay. So we do pay taxes, and a rather substantial amount at the same rate. And as I said before, or I wanted to leave this with you also, you hear the statement made once in a while, well, it's through administrative grace and liberality that the co-ops are given special treatment. Well, our Supreme Court said not very long ago, the Treasury Department, has no reserve power at all. They have no discretion in how they shall treat a taxpayer. You'll notice in all the tax scandals that you have read about, not one co-op was mentioned as receiving special tax treatment. There's no reserved authority in the Treasury Department to give any taxpayer any special tax treatment. And it's this different technique of doing business that creates the difference in the actual tax on a total volume of business.
We sort of promised ourselves to adjourn this meeting on the hour. We would like to invite any of you who feel so disposed to remain a bit after we officially adjourn. We would like to call your attention to some of this material. We'll call it educational material. Some folks might call it propaganda material. Seth, do you want to make an announcement about it before we officially...
I think most of them, Glenn, have seen what we have here. It's here for this purpose. We are glad to have you take it. Howard has brought some material. Mr. Eilenfeld has brought along the annual report of Mutual Service Insurance Company. There's material here on our films. There's an item on the tax question. Help yourself. We're glad to have you take it.
You mentioned the annual report of the insurance company. This is the same report that went to our stockholders, and which we have supplied to some of the schools and some of the libraries throughout the area. If there are no other excuse for me standing up here, let me say to you very graciously that we're happy that you came. If we've been of any help, we hope that we might be of some additional future help sometime in the future.
One second thought, Glenn. I don't know whether Gordon plugged this or not. The story that Gordon and George presented here has been written up in a brief form in the Midland Cooperator. We have reprints that are also available. And if you would like the actual talk that Gordon gave, if you will take a page out of the notebook we gave you and write your name and your school or where you'd like to have it sent, we'll be glad to mimeograph that and make it available to you. Turn it back to you.
I'd like to make this statement, and I think all our teachers agree with me, that this has been one of the finest demonstrations of visual education I've ever seen. It was really good, and I think Mr. Michelson certainly should be complimented, and also your Midland Cooperative for the very fine demonstration they gave.
Well, on behalf of those who jointly sponsored it, George, we accept it with thanks. We're sorry to disappoint some of you who expect to get a PhD degree from Vermont tomorrow.